All right, please help me welcome our speaker tonight. We have Dave from Newark, Delaware.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dave Phillips. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Dave.
I love saying that, where they don't look at you like you're strange in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, like we're different or something, because God forbid we do these things out of this book, you know. That's important. I mean, listen, my sobriety date is July 22nd of 2001. That's not my first sobriety date. Hopefully it's my last. That's a bitch getting that sobriety date and getting it right, you know. And I'm telling you, it was a long time and process of in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, in and out of treatment centers, in and out of insane asylums, I think it's about nut huts they call them, you know, drying out joints, whatever you want to call them. The things where they, like, when you break the rules, they like, strap you down face first into the mattress and then stick something in one of your cheeks. That's not fun getting high stuff, you know. I've had a lot of those experiences. A little bit older now, so this year I noticed that, like, when I was trying to take a new guy through the steps, because we don't do that from the podium, and we don't do that, by the way. The steps are not worked in this form here. It's not. It's done one-on-one with one alcoholic, breaking down his experiences according to this book of what it was like for him. And then that magical, mystical God moment where that alcoholic said, I'll do anything not to live like that. Step one is done. And then they're given an opportunity with somebody with experience who's willing to sit down with them one-on-one to take and break this down so that they can say that, hey, it worked for him and I've heard where he came from or she came from. It might work for me. And they get that little glimmer of hope. And then all of a sudden, because they don't put conditions on this journey, God has the ability to use them in a way that's only uniquely, that only God can do. And it is about God. I don't know who or what God is, but that's what it's about. And in doing that, they recover. And they live a life beyond their wildest dreams. They don't get the old life back. They get a brand new life, and they become the men and women God wants them to be. How neat is that? How beautiful is that? So I'm going to read a little bit out of the book. I don't wing this. Like I was saying, I just noticed this year, man, I'm trying to read this to a new guy, and like the words are getting fuzzy. And somebody told me, well, when you get to a certain age, your eyes, they're not flexible or some kind of, I don't know, it's something. So I went out and I got these, and my kids say, damn, Dad, it makes you look old, but I don't care. What, the gray hair doesn't give you a clue, right? I'm only 20, God, I just got here this month, look what it did, look what drugs and alcohol did to me, my God. It is funny, some of the times it's funny, but some of the things that it does is freaking tragic, you know, it really is. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Why? It says, for them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. So do you want me to explain that to you that are not informed in it? Which means that I don't do... See, there's a misconception that we as a fellowship have been pumped out by the fellowship that goes against what's outlined in this book, that you're doing... I heard it the other week in Clubhouse, and it just sent shivers up my freaking spine because there's new people in there, and they're telling, you need to work on step one for a while. That right there sentence indicates that we don't do step one in here. The whole book is based on a conception of this. When you drink, do you lose all power of choice? And you're drinking. Do you have the allergy? That's not done in here. And what happens is, and there and inevitably happens is, those that are real alcoholics, we stop on purpose. I don't want to drink anymore. I'm done. I can't do it anymore. How's that feel for you when you're sober? You know, do you experience the bedevilments on page 52? And sobriety, I'm just hanging in there. I'm not drinking and I'm a winner. And trust me, I did that for years and I wasn't winning nothing. You know, and then I have to drink again. And what the well-meaning, God-blessed fellowship that is armed with nothing except frickin' opinions tells me, well, you must not want it this bad enough, or you chose to drink again. When the book says specifically, if you're an alcoholic of our type, you've lost the power of choice and never get it back. Do I need to explain that? See, sometimes I don't know where I'm sitting at in an AA meeting because they're blaming the newcomer who doesn't know, might not even have a clue what a real alcoholic is. And they're blaming the other person that might have been sober 10 years because they just chose to drink that day. Like it was their power of choice when the book argues against that. So sometimes I don't know where I'm at. And I have to ask, like, is this an AA meeting or not? You know? And I don't do that during the meeting to cause a disruption. I just kind of get with the newcomer, the new man or woman, and get with them afterwards and say, hey, brother, hey, sister, it doesn't have to be like that. Let me show you what we do here. And then I take them and kindly walk them either to their sponsor or I take them through the steps myself. I'm responsible to do that as a recovered alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 22nd of 2001. I have a sponsor who had a working knowledge of these 12 steps, and he was given to me. I didn't pick my sponsor, thank God. I don't know how you got here and arrived here, but I was not in sane, sound condition. You know, I had been gift-wrapped for an insane asylum, and I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous' doorstep. And it wasn't by my choice. I remember my very first drink of alcohol. I was about 5 or 6 years old, and at 5 or 6, I just didn't start hitting the bottle with the other winos at kindergarten, you know. And my buddy, I remember as clear as I remember yesterday, my buddy cracked a beer open. And for you kids in the room, that's back when they had to pull the top off and threw the little tab away. Not this thing that they got nowadays, you know, for saving the environment. But I remember Mike cracking his dad's beer open and like he took a big swig and then he handed it to me. And I had what I call was an abnormal reaction to what I drank. I didn't like it, you know, and I didn't get any effect off of it. But because at 5 years old, 6 years old, I cared what Michael thought of me, I drank it, you know. And God, it was God awful, you know. And that's probably why the brewery is no longer in business. You know? It's one of those nasty ones out of Philly, you know. And man, I tell you, I didn't, you know, I know this, man. I had aspirations to do something with my life when I was a kid. I really did. I had an extremely high reading comprehension. I got into reading comic books and science fiction novels. I can credit my father for that. And I remember specifically saying that I'm going to go to MIT when I go to school. And in the 60s, MIT was the top university for engineering in the entire world. And I wanted to be an electrical engineer. And like I just spoke Saturday, and that's kind of hard for an alcoholic who's selfish and self-centered and lazy, because like that requires work, you know. And I'm cool with ideas, not if they got work to back it up, you know. And so, you know, I don't know. It's like drinking very early on took an exhilarating part of my life sometime in my teens, and I began to notice what alcohol could do for me. And the doctor's opinion explains why I'm alcoholic. It's because I like the effect produced by alcohol because there's something the matter with being sober. And I don't know about you all. I heard people say for years that they don't jail well. My alcoholism took me to federal prison for almost 4 years, and I can jail quite well, thank you very much. What I've never, ever, ever, ever been able to do is do sobriety well. Never until this time. Because there's something abnormal, practically heinous with David being sober because he has a mind that just won't shut the F up. Now, I don't know what your mind does with, and what we call that in our sponsor lineage is untreated alcoholism, but my mind literally runs a million miles an hour. And like, I'll be having conversations with people in my vehicle that aren't there, you know, and that, well, you know, you shouldn't have said that and stuff like that. And I'm sitting there having arguments as I'm driving down the road. Now, I know none of you all do that. You know, we're all just a bastion of mental health in here. But when I'm sober, you know, me not drinking, it's not a comfortable state, you know. And I'm thinking how, like, Johnny's screwing my old lady while I'm out there working for Johnny's dad, you know. Because Johnny just went to go get material, really. You know, and, like, my mind, it paints these pictures that just, I don't know if they're real or not. They may be real, but it's like it's a worst-case scenario and stuff. And I'm full of fear. You know, and I'm full of anxiety, and I'm full of, you know, and then I'm depressed when I'm thinking about me and how much of a failure and an unsuccessful life that I lived. And then I compare that, and I can only live sober for that long to where I've got to drink. You know, and it gets bad. So I've had some interesting experiences. My best day drinking is still better than my worst day sober. Can't help that it's not your experience. I don't know where alcohol took you, but I lived in Hawaii for 3 years, from 80 to 83, and coming to on a beach. I never hung out in Waikiki because it was too touristy, but going out to the beaches on North Shore, you know, with the scantily clad women and coming to and seeing all that. And that was drunk, so that really wasn't a bad day, right? I'd say it's not a bad day. Coming to sober, 4 years sober, I have a drug-induced coma, paralyzed from the waist down with a shattered pelvis, shattered sacrum, and should have died experienced sober. There's like that was a bad day, so I can't compare the two. You know, so I don't know what any of that nonsense is. I'm not real big on AA party line, one-liners, or any of that shit because I think it's all nonsense. You know, I really honestly do in my experience. I think we do a disservice when we water this message down with just don't drink and you'll be okay. You know, I know I lived in Hawaii for 3 years, and the reason I went to Hawaii is because I had become self-employed in the late 70s. And my sponsor gave me a little talk one day about me making up my own definition for words. I don't know if you have that type of sponsors, but my sponsor like will actually listen to what I'm saying when he's not in the conversation, and then will pull me to the side and say, "Can I talk to you?" And it's never over good stuff. And one day he did that, and he goes, "Look, I've been listening to you for a while, Dave, saying you've been, you know," and it was like, I used to borrow my parents' vehicle. Sounds reasonable, right? He goes, "So how old were you when you borrowed your parents' vehicle?" And I was like, "I don't know, 14. So let's assume, in quotation marks, assume that, you know, you're not on a farm and you didn't have a driver's license. So let's just get down to what the truth is, because we know you..." He goes, "We know you like dealing in fiction, Dave, but we in AA like to deal in fact. Did you ask your parents' permission?" "What's that?" I was clueless, man. He goes, "Dave, that's not borrowing, that's stealing everywhere else in the damn universe." I didn't say that anymore from then on. You know, it's like, get the dictionary out and start learning what words actually mean. Amazing, when I began doing that, life started not being too bad. When I, you know, when somebody said something to me, I didn't get offended. Oh, that's what that word means. So anyway, I was a thief in the 70s, and because by the time I was 15, I stuck a needle in my arm, and I pursued that to the gates of insanity and death. I had already been escorted out of a high school. I crapped on every opportunity I was given to do right stuff, from church to school and everything. And my father died in 1979, and... you know, that's when alcohol basically really got my attention. My buddy I called my friend, and he was like a spiritual advisor, like a sponsor to me, and a lot older. I always hung out with the older crowd, and because, like I'm telling you, when I stuck a needle in my arm at 15, it's like the greatest thing I've ever experienced in my, it's like a crack addict hitting their first hit and it like working, you know, or booze working for the first time. And I'm trying to get everybody to, "You got to try this." And they're all looking at me with that head out of the neck experience, you know. But the older guys and the older women, they knew what it was like. And they were like, "Yeah, we know." And so I hung out with Charlie, and I'm telling you, man, Charlie, my father died, and I called him up, and he knew what would take that away. And so we went to the liquor store, and he got the biggest bottle of Orange Label vodka and grapefruit juice. And I had already drank both of those and didn't like either one. But you know what I found out that night? If you put grapefruit and vodka together, they're palatable. And they like cancel each other's taste out, you know. And it's like, wow! You know, and something was going to happen that night that caught my attention. Alcohol took away the sting of my dad's death. Now, I could not stand my father. I really couldn't. But alcohol did something that night that literally, it caught my attention on a molecular level. And from that point on, I knew alcohol, no matter what, would take and fix everything in me that was wrong. Right or wrong, good or bad, alcohol would do it. So at being unemployable at 17, the military back in the late 70s would take anybody. And we had a little problem with Iran. They took our diplomats hostage. And I got all fired up about it, and I wanted to go kill Iranians. And so I went and joined the service. And no high school diploma, and I passed their test, and they gave me shots and their physical, and I got shipped off to Hawaii. And, man, I tell you, I could drink legally at 17 with that military ID no matter where I went. And I fell in love with Jack Daniels. And when I got through, falling out of road marches and runs and started actually doing what they said to do sober with willpower, I learned that I could do what my mind said the body can't do. And I got in the best physical shape of my life. I spent 3 years and I loved it. I didn't like running 3 miles in the morning, not having no sleep because we drank at Waikiki till 4 o'clock in the morning, but I did it, and I learned how to run and puke, and you don't fall out, because if you do and you totally fall out and don't get back up, you got to go run at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I ain't doing that. So you puke and you get back in formation and keep running, man, I tell you, I got in trouble in every single country that we did maneuvers in, that I had access to alcohol, And I mean, I'm telling you, I don't know. Is there anybody here when you're actively drinking can turn down free booze? This room's silent. It's like there's two parties here, I'm telling you, man, we had this New Zealand guy that was in the service and they loved us. We had to pay for it. We didn't have to pay for any booze when we were in New Zealand. And they loved us for Vietnam for some reason. I don't know why, but they did. And this guy said, I got a Chinese restaurant, and you can eat as much Chinese food as you want and all the booze you can drink. And so that's what we did, except it wasn't legal for us to do. So we were sneaking off post to do this 5 nights in a row, and we did it. And we were infantry, so we escape and evade back on the post. And sure enough, the company commander and the first sergeant lines us up, and he gives us some consequences. Say, look, we know what you've been doing, but if you'll stop, we'll let bygones be bygones. That's what I thought he said. Well, apparently 4 of those guys weren't alcoholic. I know I am. I knew I was back then. I didn't know I was, but I was. And me and Corporal Black, we knew where we were going that night. And sure enough, we had already made a plan. The guy was going to meet us. And sure enough, at some time after midnight when we came back on post, all my stuff was gone. All Corporal Black's stuff was gone. And we had to go report to the company CP and talk to the company commander. And I almost got court-martialed for it, For anybody that I did service with who went with me to New Zealand, I apologize from the podium, because apparently that night this is all, you might be alcoholic. My sponsor does a thing about you might be alcoholic if when you come to, you need the charge sheet if you come to the next day in jail to find out what you're in jail for, or you use a smoke detector as a cooking alarm. You might be alcoholic. I didn't have a clue what happened that night. All I knew is that we broke into the company beer tent and we popped our own kegs and stuff. And like New Zealand has this real sweet beer. But I won this drinking game that night. And I don't remember any of it. All I know is I fell backwards I was in 2 feet of snow and I fell backwards while I was urinating and kept urinating and told my guys who came out to get me. They were like, come on, you're going to get hypothermia and freeze to death. And I'm like, no, I got this, leave me alone. But apparently I peed on everybody's duffel bag there that night. So much for my Article 15. I got the company commander and first sergeant back, apparently in a drunken blackout, I don't know, By the end of 3 years, the military said, Mr. Phillips, your services are really well qualified for certain agencies, but ours isn't one of them. And they asked me to leave. So at the end of 3 years, I get an honorable discharge. I'm in the best shape of my life. I ain't stuck a needle in my arm in 3 years. And I'm like, I don't know. I end up in January flying into New York City. I think it's LaGuardia, some airport up there. And I'm in shirts and a T-shirt. I'm so tanned, it took me a year to lose my tan. And before I made it home to my mom's house, because mom has always been a rescuer of mine, a refuge of mine, I always ended up back there when times got bad. By the time I ended back up in my mom's, I had, $2,000-$3,000. By the time I ended up back there, I'm redoing you-know-what, and I'm dead broke. And so I didn't have any prospects for employment. I had got my high school diploma, and I applied to the Delaware State Police, and they accepted. They sent me a letter, Mr. Phillips, you are currently enrolled in the fall class of the Delaware State Police Academy. And I'm like, yeah, imagine me with a gun. Yeah, see your license. Got any drugs? I would have made cops for sure, you know. And then my Vietnam vet buddy asked me, he goes, Dave, how are you going to arrest people for what you like to do? And I did the Alchemax. That means I got to stop. And, like, there went that. You know? And about a year after that, I was in the Air National Guard working on helicopters, not qualified to do that, but they let me, you know? And I took a flight aptitude test, and I passed it and got offered a job to go learn how to be in warrant officer school to learn how to fly helicopters. And within 3 or 4 months after taking that test and being offered that job, I was headed on to federal prison. Because I had become self-employed again, and the feds didn't like that. They let me know that when I stood at sentencing, you know. I don't know. I had to speak from a topic at Saturday's Acts, and I've never done spoke from a topic. You know, the only topic I've ever known is I'm not guilty, and that was given to me by my attorney, well paid for, you know. So I don't know, you know. I remember the judge going 7 years, and I thought it was like 2, and I'm like, whoa. God. And I'm looking back and my poor mother is like, oh my God, I'm her only son, you know, and I couldn't even, I just got one glimpse of my mom and I'm going back and I cried in that cell. How this future that I had, because I had gotten out of my difficulties. The military, I learned about morals. I learned that my body, I can ignore it and make it do. I could run 2 miles in less than 13 minutes. I could do push-ups till the cow. I learned I wasn't stupid because I went to high school while I was in there. What happened to all that? Because my alcoholism, untreated, even back then, dictated that I lived by the principle of more. And more can never be satisfied. I've even done that in sobriety, and it's not a good thing, guys. You know, it's about me. And that never ends well. If not for me, but for others who might suffer along that journey. And so the federal prison, man, I get in jail and I'm with some real criminals, you know, and I'm in a co-ed federal prison. They got women and there's no fence and you can walk to the liquor store. And I'm doing college while I'm in there. And man, I'm telling you, you could hold their hands. You could do other stuff. You don't get caught. And like my girlfriend had no teeth and like I haven't done anything with her. And thank God, man, because right then AIDS, they were doing these AIDS tests and stuff. And like all of a sudden everybody went and got tested and like half the compound of women and guys left, you know, and everybody was like shitting bricks, you know, because like there went my, oh my God, I got to get it, you know. And so what a scary time to be. But I'm telling you, I got out on a 32-hour. They actually gave me a 32-hour furlough. Not a good thing. Here I am. I'm 18 months sober. You know, and what did I do? I did the Alchemath. I can give a clean breathalyzer in 32 hours. I can go get drunk. So that's what I did. I went to the, and we, my poor mom and Charlie, my Vietnam vet friend, came, and Charlie played an intricate part in my life until this time in sobriety, man. I'm telling you, man, he was a good dude. Nothing wrong with Charlie. But I'm telling you, man, on like the sixth beer, he's whipping out his non-approved leafy green stuff, and we debated on how much of that stuff I can inhale and give a clean urine. And what I didn't know is the urinalysis that they were going to give me is a full spectrum analysis. And like 4 hits sounded reasonable. I swear to God, because 10 I knew it would be too much. 2 weeks later, I found out no, 4 hits is way too much. And now I went from a co-ed, no fence, no motion detectors, to upstate New York. And my cellmate is Godfather of Rochester, New York, and the guards are bringing him food out of respect of who he is, because they know who he is. And I remember him asking me, what are you in here for, kid? And I'm like, well, I don't want to tell him what I'm in there for. I told him I kidnapped the governor's dog, you know? And like, I held it for ransom, too. We were torturing that little Pekingese monkey, you know? And it's not like he could get on, hey, let's do a background, and you know? It's like, I fit in there too, man. Like I'm trying to be Italian, and as you can tell, I'm not Italian. I'm saying nigga, and I'm talking with my hands, and I'm throwing garlic on my food. Man, I remember this one time, I threw so much freaking garlic on my spaghetti and shit, man. They're like, and it was offensive to the Italian monsters, and they're like, get over there, man. And like, I'm just trying to impress them. I'm just trying to fit in. I'm just trying to be one of the guys, you know? Oh, my God. They love me so much, they only gave me 1 month in a halfway house. You know? And, like, they let me out on my first overnight weekend pass, and I just wanted to be with her. I was tired of being with him and him. That's a visual for those on the thing, you know? And I'm telling you, I didn't know who her was, but I wanted to, and somebody handed me a drink, and they had that 10 o'clock curfew call where you got to be there sober for the call. Not my experience, you know? And like, I called him, and I wasn't quite blacked out yet, and I called him at, like, I don't know, midnight, you know? And I'm here, you know? And, man, all I know is I came to the next morning in a holding cell at the halfway house. Somebody had vomited on me. There was pink in the vomit. I don't remember drinking anything pink or eating anything pink. And somebody had peed on me. You know? And they're telling me, they're bringing a mop and a thing that for me to clean the cell. And I'm like, well, I didn't do this, you know? Man, I swear to God, man, it's like, you know, when alcohol is working and you don't see the consequences, it can be bad. And but that's not the real bad part. It's when you see the consequences and you have no way to get out of them. Yeah, you all know that, you know. Let's fast forward. I ended up in AA in 1992. I stayed here as a result of passing a DUI class because I went to AA the last 2 weeks of that class. Okay? I stayed here from that invitation as a meeting maker, making, you know, add some cuss words in there, you know, mofo, you know. And I was making thousands of meetings, man. You ever hear an AA? Let me see a show of heads. Have you ever heard an AA? If you don't drink today, you're a winner. Yeah. How many times? You know how much crap that is? Bullshit? Let's run that past people who, like your loved ones, to see if they think you're a winner. Ooh, that's some truth there. Living sober by the principle of more, it's like I took a woman hostage. She got pregnant, and now she's attached to me. I did the right thing. We got married. Wasn't her idea. It seemed reasonable. My, I had an AA wedding party, you know? And like, I don't know, after 2 years, I'm cheating on her with a gal I met in AA. Now, I'm sober. I went to AA that day in a meeting. And then the next day I went to a meeting. Go ask my wife if she thinks I was a winner because I didn't drink. Let's go a little bit. I don't know what your untreated alcoholism looks like, but let's go right to page 52. And let me explain to you what mine looks like. And I'll read what the words say, but I'll put it into drunk talk, what that looks like for me. It's not pleasant. We are having trouble with personal relationships. She's a bitch. He's an asshole. God! If you don't speed up, buddy, I'm late again. We couldn't control our emotional natures. You know what that looks like? Let me explain something to you, and this is not pretty. My 2-year-old son, who's now in college, did something while I was babysitting him that night when I was about 18 months or 2 years sober. That I would fly into fits of rage. Like, God forbid my children spilled a soda at the table because I would lose it. But I was the only parent there that night, and I'm sitting there, I'm banging them up against the wall. And then I put my hands around the little boy's neck until he turned blue. Explain to me what the hell that kid did. Couldn't control my emotional nature. That's a mild way to put it, man. That's me as an untreated alcoholic. I went to meetings the next day and the day after and was doing 2 and 3 meetings a day, sharing that from the rooms, and people were, you can't share that. Nobody's coming up to me and say, hey, little buddy, why don't you do these things called the steps? Because you know what I would have told them? I have a sponsor. I've done them. I've done my version of the steps. I've done my program. You tell me as a fellowship I can do that. How's that working for you? How's your family sees and experience it working for you? I can tell you, man, I'll be making amends to my family for making amends for not living this sober for the rest of my life. And I have to, and I'm responsible to do that. At the end of 2.5 years, I had to drink no matter what. Yeah, I just heard it from a guy 25 years sober say it from our clubhouse. Just don't drink no matter what. I drink no matter what because I can't stand sobriety no matter what. How long can you stay sober with those bedevilments? I can't do it. Because every time, every day, it's that much worse. I might get a raise or get a new toy. You ever buy stuff to make yourself feel good? Go ahead, it's a selfish program. Go treat yourself good. You ever hear that crap? It's been about my, you know, when these things called, when my sponsor, when I went out to do my 8-step list that I had mostly completed, and he said, David, don't think about adding yourself to the list. You've been doing for you for your whole entire life. You know how you make amends to yourself in AA? You do the damn steps and you live this as a way of life and you will make amends to yourself. It's not about you. So anyway, at the end of that run, man, I was hitting it freaking hard. Now, I don't know what your runs look like, but mine get progressively freaking worse and stuff. At the end of that run, I put the group of people together because I started thinking about doing the unlicensed pharmaceuticals. God forbid, you know, because just drinking ain't enough because I'm only an alcoholic. But it seems natural, like when you're spinning and you don't. I said, you ever set the foot down and you're still spinning? Or you're driving down the road and you're seeing quadruple and like you're still seeing double and shit? Chemicals. I love chemicals, man. Crack, meth, coke, and all that stuff. Takes that shit away, man. And I'm telling you, dude, I get on these runs and stuff, and they got those things got a life of their own, man. And I can't. And at the end of that run, man, I'm putting a group of people together to rob banks on Federal Reserve drop day because that's when the big cash is there. 2-3 minutes. You know, I did all that time with bank robbers. I took notes up in here. You know, I'll succeed where you failed. You know. And, really? So, needless to say, at the end of that run, I came back in November 18th of 1995, beaten and demoralized, and I was given sponsors that time who tried to take me through the steps, and all of them got me up to the same old amends, and being an ex-con, I know better. I can't do that. Why? Because it's me snitching on myself. You mean I got to go and tell? They don't even know what I did. That's telling on yourself. Convict rule, criminal rule number one. Never tell on yourself. But what I tell my sponsor is, yeah, I just made an amend yesterday, you know? I made one this morning, you know? Because he would ask me, how's those amends going, Dave? Consummate actor. After 4.5 years, I'm no longer alcoholic. I've had about every job you can have in AA other than delegate. I had jobs they don't even have in AA. I was a baker for a group I started. We had speakers just like this, you know, scheduled 6 months in advance and stuff, you know. I liked sounding good. I just wasn't willing to do the work. I used to go to this meeting off the Beltway and would hear these people 30, 40, 50 years sober. The average length of time in that room was 40 years. And I would hear, and the room was like this, and they were packed. And I would hear what these guys and gals would say, and I'd come up to my clubhouse up in Newark, and then I'd regurgitate it with my little spin. And people would come up to me and say, man, you sound good. And that just made my ego go, wham! I love sounding good. It wasn't my experience. I wasn't willing to do the work. And sure enough, I drank again. You know, I remember sitting across from my non-alcoholic wife one day. And the way I remember it is I asked her if she minded me taking a sip of her fruity cocktail drink. The way she knows it to be. And I was sober. That's important. I was delusional sober. Is that, David, you didn't ask me. You just reached over and took a big old slug. What I do remember is this. Set all that aside. What I said to myself was, David, that's the stupidest thing you ever did. You just threw away 5 years of sobriety. Why would you do that? I didn't immediately start hitting the bottle. But what happens is that the book says we have this peculiar mental twist. Where you can't think the drink through. But you're telling that from the room. Quit it. Real alcoholics can't think the freaking drink through. With any consistency. There will come a time. The book says that. There will come a time and place where I can't do that. These stupid things that they tell us. Like, hey, here's a desire chip. If you want a drink, stick it under your tongue. And if it melts, no chewing. What do you think? I'm freaking retarded? Come on. And your stupid phone list, like I'm going to remember that when I have an obsession? The last time I came to here, I had a sponsee with me. He had a bottle. None of us knew he was getting ready to drink. And he had already drank that day. Because they're consummate actors. And when he got home, when he got back to his car, he polished that bottle off. And he had phoneless. He had coins. And all this carnival tactic, bullshit. Get rid of it, because it's killing people. This is 2010. Why is it when this book, in the first edition, I read one last year at Bill Wilson's house up in East Dorset where it says ex-alcoholic, which, by the way, we all are once you've done the steps. They kept it. It's in the service manual. And you know what that term means? It means that somebody, and Bill Wilson wrote it, look it up for yourself. Ex-alcoholic, the definition of that means, and it came from Bill's own work. It's in our service manual. Somebody who no longer imbibes alcohol, sober, we're all sober, right? And lives the 12-step spiritual principles as a way of life. Are you all doing that? Because that's the difference. No real alcoholic sobers well. How many people have you heard for years that are 20 and 30 years sober that go out and commit suicide? Why? Because sobriety gets so painful and they can't go back to the drinking, so death looks like the only solution. You know? I'm telling you, this is, from every place I speak, this is what gives me passion, because I think we do a disservice not only to the newcomer, but the person that might be in here that are in their last 30 days of sobriety. And they don't know it. They just know that the bedevilments are kicking their ass, and they don't even know that's what it is. There's something wrong. See, I've known for decades there's something wrong with me. I just didn't know what it was. I didn't know it was a spiritual malady, which means a disconnect from God, which means that my mind, and to be disconnected from God, you got to lie to yourself. Your mind has to lie, because if God is either inside of us or He's not, it says it is, that He, she, or it is. And every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. That means God's already inside. But my mind will lie through a process of delusion that builds a picture that, like, I'm a fish. And imagine I'm a fish and I'm swimming, but I've told a story so intricate that I think I'm flying. And the other fish look at me like, you're in water, dude. And I can't see it. It's like somebody who hasn't showered for weeks. You can't smell it, but you sit next to somebody that showers on a regular basis and they're getting up and moving away from you. You're like, why, I don't stink. That run, I'm telling you, was a run from hell. And I get here and I'm dying. And what was worse for me is I'm doing everything that's suggested. I'm writing a gratitude list every day. By the way, don't tell your people to do that. God forbid if that's your experience. Gratitude is an action word. If you have to talk about being grateful, you've just blown it. Because it's meant, there's a series of actions to be taken here. But I did it because I didn't argue. I got so beat up that all I know is, like, I'm begging whatever God there is for death. I came to AA in June of that year. I did the math. I said, I was here 2.5 years, 4.5 years. I'll be here the rest of my life, get at least 10 years. Within 2 days, I'm pounding my fist on a bar. Had no intention of drinking it when we went in there, because all we went in there, my coworkers even said, David, when you're up there, the bartender, order a Pepsi. They didn't tell the bartender. What came out of my mouth was, F it, give me a Budweiser. And I took those guys hostage that night once I started drinking. Because I don't know what you do when you drink, but if I don't have no money, you got to pay for me. What's your drug of choice? I like yours. Yeah, I had a guy, man. I swear to God, I love this guy, man. He made the mistake while we were drinking to leave a quarter pound of pot in the floorboard of my car. I helped him look for it that night. I got a DUI out that night saying pot for sale outside of the quad in University of Delaware, you know. I'm just trying to be a good sale, you know. I'm not trying to do anything wrong. I remember in that DUI, I ended up saying the alphabet in French because I couldn't say it in English. I was so freaking drunk. Ah, oh, man. So I get here and I'm writing gratitude lists and I'm sharing at every meeting because I'm told to. And they told me to only talk about the good thing. And day 13, I tried to kill myself in my wife's new truck. She told me to go back to drinking because there's something wrong with David sober, because it scares him. My wife, she used to think by shutting the door, the argument's over. You ever do that and the argument's not over? What do you do? don't know what you do. I kick the door off the hinges. I'm not done yet. I got to get my point across. I'm doing stuff that husbands don't do to their kids, that don't do to their spouses. I'm doing heinous stuff. I'm doing worse stuff than an animal does to its kin. And I can't stop myself. Because sobriety is just, it's so painful. All that ended in a meeting in August of 2001 when I heard a lady celebrating her third anniversary. And I was at her first, and she was more happy at her third than she was at her first. Her drunk law did not catch my attention, but she talked about coming out of this drunken haze, and the eyes that stared back at her were black as coal, and she wasn't born with black eyes. And I had that experience, and it hooked me. And then she talked a message of hope that God came through that woman and spoke to me that night, and I something happened. My non-alcoholic wife was with me, and I remember on the way going home, did you feel something during that meeting? And my wife said yes. I said, can you explain it? She goes, no. It was so powerful, the message of hope that Doreen carried that night. You can't tell me that I have to hear it from another guy or some person that I can identify with their drinking. You can't tell me that, because God came through that woman that night that touched me and made me want this more than anything, than life itself, than my next breath. And that night, I went up and asked this old gray-haired guy, and he gave me a sponsor. I didn't know that guy from Adam, and he asked me, George asked me, he goes, you got a big book? And I lied and said, yeah. Luckily, my wife was standing there, and she had one, because she wanted to know why David does what he does. She wanted to be armed with the facts about me. And she's not in Al-Anon. She can't stand it, because all they do in Al-Anon, according to her, is just whine. She doesn't see any sense in group therapy. You know? That's her experience, you know? And so George asked me, he goes, you know where the doctor's opinion is? And I was like, yeah. And I went right to here. You might get a chuckle out of this. Dr. Bob's nightmare. He didn't do that. I didn't know. See, when this was a first edition big book, the doctor's opinion was chapter one. You think we should have left it there? I've been to college. No school I've ever been in has ever asked me to read the Roman numeral section of a book. So why would I do it here? Makes sense, right? To me it did. But you know what? Because you ever get to that point in your drinking where you no longer put conditions on what you will and won't do? Where God can use you as He sees fit, and you'll follow another man or woman's direction like your life depends on it? Like the desperation of a drowning man. Can you imagine if you're out? Have you ever seen somebody drown? I have. They got reality shows. They show it all the time. What happens with that person that's sitting there going down for the last time, and the lifeguard takes that buoy thing out? Do you see him sitting there refusing the buoy? No, they don't. I don't care if they have an aversion to the color pink or red or whatever color the buoy is. They'll grab that shit. They'll drown the lifeguard just to stay afloat. That's how I had to pursue this thing. And my alcohol took me to the point where I got to that point where I would do anything. The next year, I drove almost 1,000 miles a week to follow my sponsor, my grand sponsor, my great grand. When I wasn't with him, I was with my grand sponsor or my great grand sponsor. And mind you, you know what they told me? See, my fellowship locally said David shared every meeting. You know what my sponsor's crowd, actually my sponsor, and they all said it. Don't share in any meetings, kid. Nobody wants what you got. Now, they didn't do it to embarrass me. They didn't do it to hurt my feelings. Because they knew in a meeting we have a responsibility to share what it was like, what happened, but more important, what's it like as a spiritually awakened, recovered alcoholic? A message of hope. I'm sure, you know, your numerous arrests are very fascinating talking, like how many times you've been freaking arrested, David. But you know, when he told me that, he goes, David, you don't even want what you got. And I couldn't argue with that. But you can talk here. So the only place they'd let me speak every week, and I got to speak every week, was in Mercy Detox. You know, for one week, I thought I was getting through to a guy in there. And I looked down and he was peeing on himself. So apparently what I was saying didn't make a damn bit of difference, you know. And so we went right through, man. George That night I met George. The very next day, he's taking me through the first four steps out of this book. We knelt down and did the third step prayer together. He held my hand. I didn't think it was gay. I didn't question it. I just, okay. You ever get to the point in your untreated alcoholism where the most spiritual thing you can say is okay? And you actually, your actions indicate your willingness? When do you know an alcoholic's lying? Their lips move. When do you know they're telling the truth? Feet first, baby. So I like the name of this group, man. Feet first. What a very apropos. But I digress. So I go through this thing, and while I'm writing my four step, I decided to make amends with my mother-in-law, because apparently in my sick, delusional mind, sober, I thought she owed me money. And I remember saying to Kay, I forgive you for everything you've ever done to me. Now, mind you, I never ran that by any spiritual advisor. I'm writing a freaking four step. I'm actually writing a four step, but I decided to go to step nine. And I tell you what, that wasn't her response. Man, I had to hold the phone out to her. And the last thing I heard her specifically say was, I never want to see you ever again. Click! And you know what the shame of that is? Within 2 weeks, I was up to doing my amends and blew the only opportunity I had to make that to her. It took over 3 years of her watching whether this thing worked or not before they would even allow me onto their yard. Not a lot of people, even amongst my own crowd, and I think it's a shame, it's a big deal of doing everything right out of the book. They think you can wing this. My experience is if I don't do everything that's outlined in the book, especially in the four step, I'm liable to take those nasty character defects, sins of omission, things I'm not doing, sins of commission, things I did, into all my future relationships. My first sponsor, God bless him, he didn't do the four step exactly as was outlined. There's four prayers in that four step. Page 67 has two prayers, top paragraph. Allows God to change me. You ever hear an AA that if you have a resentment towards somebody, pray for them? You ever hear that? Is that even in this book? No, it's not. Understand this. With the resentment, I've taken poison, so I'm going to pray for you because I'm taking poison expecting you to die. The prayer is right here. The resentment removal prayer. But see, my sponsor didn't know that. I'm not faulting him. There's an old timer said, kid, don't ever let anybody else read your big book for you. Why? Because you're liable to be open to their opinions and interpretation. And what if they miss something that you needed? Here it is right here. The second prayer, which is if you have a resentment towards somebody and they were on your four step, and in the original manuscript it said when the person next offended, because we don't change people, places, and things in AA either. We're not even powerless over people, places, and things. If you're playing the role God has assigned, you don't need the power over people, places, and things, right? Makes sense? I'm not powerless anymore. I haven't been powerless since 2001 when I showed up in here. Lack of power. I found the power here. It's right here. But here's a resentment prayer. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, repeat after me, this is a sick man. This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? Here's the prayer. God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. Is that so hard? No. Why on earth would I need to pray for them that they get what I want? Because that's what I heard. When that may not even be God's will. Isn't that being selfish toward God, dictating what God should give that person? Prayer's a funny thing. Simply talking to God. But am I making demands on God to do it my way? I've done that for years. I remember sitting in there, God, I'll do anything, you know. And then when I got 7 years, God don't work. We get a my mistake list. Page 67, third paragraph down, referring to our list again. We have a fears inventory and a fear prayer. Repeat after me. God, remove my fears and direct my attention to what you would have me be. I'm not going to make you say it. Because you ever hear there's such things as good fear? That's a load of crap. Fear prevents me from being the man God wants me to be. So why would I? It's not common sense that I don't put my finger in a live electrical socket. I mean, it's not fear that I don't do that. I don't do it because it would be stupid. I don't have to fear that. Oh, God, it's electricity. Come on, guys. And then finally, the last important thing is on page 69. And it's not really a sex list. It's a relationship inventory. It's a conduct inventory. And there's a new sex ideal that comes out of it. It's like a six column inventory. The new ideal, what should I have done differently, including up to never being in a relationship in the first place? And then saying the sex prayer. God, mold my new ideals and help me to live up to them. You ever hear it like, don't get in any relationships your first year? Is that in the book? Like, I like being the arbiter of your sex conduct. Hey, stay away from her. Hey, baby. That's what I'd say. I've seen it. It's like, you know, or they're playing hookup. You know, I'm gonna be the dating thing. You know, and it's like AA's getting in trouble in our own thing of people hooking each other up, and they just end up in all kinds of tragic situations, and then it comes back to bite them in their ass. Why don't you just do what God wants you to do instead of doing what you think you ought to do? I have to. I come up with real great ideas sometimes. They look great. They sound great because they came out of me. But the results are real bad. I'll share this one with you. And because we're at the top of the hour, I'll share this one with you. A friend of mine was visiting from Puerto Rico. I got into skydiving and base jumping. It's illegal, by the way. Should have been a clue there, but yeah. Anyway, I said, hey, DK, watch this, as I flew the canopy directly into the ground and smashed myself. And that's where that drug-induced coma came from. And I thought I was in a movie. I did. I come to and I got these big old sponge gloves on me and I'm crying because apparently I'm cut from here to here and I got my belly's opened up like that because they couldn't stop the bleeding. I punctured my femoral artery. Shattered my pelvis, my sacrum, broke both my feet. And I come to and I'm on drugs that I can't even spell at the time. I'm on fentanyl, man. And I knew that was killing the heroin addicts. And I'm like, oh my God. But I shot myself in the leg that month with a roofing gun. Nearly missed the artery. I dug the nail out with a utility knife on the scaffold. About passed out. Got down, bandaged myself, and went back to work because I own a company. Can't go. And I can't do any narcotics because AA Fellowship says you'll blow your sobriety date. Anybody here got an MD after their name? But they love to dispense medical advice. So that I'd only taken Tylenol. They didn't ask me what I should be on in the hospital. So, I remember crying to my sponsor, and like, I'm not crying because I'm paralyzed. I'm impotent. I can't even feel my backside. I can't even wipe my own butt. I'm crying to him because I'm on narcotics. He said, David, you'll get through this. You've had a sponsor. You follow the directions of the steps to the best of your ability, which means you gave it an honest effort, and you'll get through this. And I was like, okay. You know what my crowd did for me? They bought me AA meetings. That ain't enough for an alcoholic of my type. You know what they did for me? They bought me people to take through the steps. I'm like, are you serious? I can't even wipe my... What do you want me to do with these guys? They said, David, specifically, I'm not sure who said it. One of them said it, and I was drugged up at the time. They said, David, quit thinking about you. That got you into that bed in the first place, and think how you can help him. And that's what I did. He didn't stay sober, but I did. I was going to meetings in wheelchairs. And see, this is what gets my attention, man. I'm telling you, God has showed up in my... there's a guy, Greg, who shared at a meeting in Glen Burnie, who said the greatest day up to that day in his life was the day God showed up in his car, and he knew it was God. 3 days later, God showed up in my van, and I knew for a fact it was God. I became speechless. My jaw dropped and my eyes got full of tears, and they weren't tears of sorrow. They were overwhelming tears. For the first time, I was speechless And that caught my attention. God has continued to, he's told me, if you do what we do, who or what God is will show up in your life and you'll know it's God. Because you'll know that he has not forgotten you. And so here I am, I'm taking this guy through the steps, Mike, and I don't want to do this. I got out of the wheelchair, I'm doing physical therapy, and I'm learning how to walk, and I'm in this meeting, and I'm in, because I come off of all the narcotics, because I didn't like being on them, man. I don't like being in an altered state of reality. I don't. I just don't. I don't even like taking cold medicine, because I don't like changing how I feel. I love being sober. You would too if you had experienced what I've gotten to experience. Because this is a life beyond my wildest dreams. And so, but anyway, getting back to Mike, I'm taking him through the steps. And I don't want to do this because I'm at this meeting and I'm in so much agony. I'm sitting in the chair on my hands going, oh, because I'm like in physical, I'm almost in tears. It's so painful. And I'm dreading what I got to do because I know I got to take a book similar to this. Not this particular big book because that book was so worn that by the end of 3 years, I had it, or 4 years, whatever. And I know I'm dreading this because I know we're going to spend an hour, hour and a half going through this book. Because see, this is the way it is. I say a little prayer, which is God, set aside everything I think I know about the big book, the 12 steps, sponsorship, and being a sponsor for a brand new experience for me and this person that I'm working with. You use me as you see fit. I don't know what you need. I don't know if you need to go through this for up to the 4 steps in 20 minutes. I don't know if we need to spend hours breaking these words down. I don't know how freaking delusional anybody I work with. It's not my job to know anymore. I'm dependent on my employer, which is God. And so we do the set-aside prayer, man. You know what? An hour and a half goes by like that. We get in this thing called a state of flow where all time and space is gone. And we come out of it, and I think we're up to the 3rd step, and I think we did some closing prayer or whatever. We're somewhere in the steps. Mike goes his way, I go my way. The whole hour and a half, my pain was gone like I was never injured. Explain to me where my pain went. Come on! I know where it went. It says in the other book, which our book was based on, Spiritual Principles, that if it's in his way, he will remove it. So apparently, it would have been in God's way for him to work with me, to work with Mike, if I was in all that pain. How do I know this? Because I'm riding down Main Street in Newark, and all of a sudden it felt like somebody hit me in the back of my freaking ear with a horrendous pain again. And I, first thing I'd say, well, God, why couldn't you just keep it? Sounds reasonable. But God, I'm telling you guys, if I can leave you with this, if nothing else, God has continued to demonstrate those miraculous events. They call them miracles. So I can see it, not only see it, experience it, and then use those. And what's the 3rd step prayer say? Take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. Ready? Of His love, His power, His love, His power, His way of life. May I do thy will always. Thank you.